the influences of the media.
Teenage savages go wild in a juvenile jungle of lust and lawlessness.
A flood tide of filth threatening to pervert an entire generation of our American children.
I'm Dr. Ben Litherland.
And I'm Dr. Richard McCulloch.
We research media audiences.
And this is Ill Effects, the good podcast about bad media influences.
Richard.
Ben.
Do racing games cause reckless and dangerous driving?
Straight off the bat, I'm going to say this one smells like bullshit.
It smells like bullshit. It smells like teen bullshit. So, in 2006, two teenagers in Toronto were having a street race. One of them loses control of the car, drives into a taxi, and sadly kills the taxi driver.
Okay.
The police find a copy of Need for Speed on the passenger seat. Have you played Need for Speed?
A very long time ago. I think on the Sega Saturn.
Wow. Do you want to explain
another way of answering that would be no, I haven't.
So we'll talk about Need for Speed in a second. So the detective who investigates the crash, he tells the Canadian National Post, a game is a game. And when you get behind the wheel of a car, it's not a game anymore. And when something tragic happens in a huge crash with a lot of smoke, there is no reset button. You can't start over with a new car and a new life. There is a small percentage who have difficulty separating reality and simulation or fantasy. It's a very, very small percentage.
I mean, we've heard this before. This is
hang on.
The alarm bells are going off. Yeah, that small slither of vulnerable society.
Yes. So I think it's interesting. So sometimes I guess when people talk about it like this, that small percentage is bigger than I think the police officer is making it out to be. I'm kind of fascinated that he does, in this instance, say very, very small percentage.
True. Yeah, some credit.
I suppose the interesting question for him as a police officer and for us in this episode is what percentage?
Yeah. I mean, the question that I'm thinking of straight away is the game's on the passenger seat. So they obviously weren't playing it at the time. And what else was in the car? Had they just been shopping? Was there a cabbage in the boot? Should we blame cabbages for causing the crash? It feels like, I don't know, I mean, straight away I'm thinking of the sort of the James Bulger, Child's Play 3, where is the evidence that they played this game? And even though I'm willing to accept that they probably had played the game if it's in there, but like, how are we getting from there to that it's caused this crash?
Cards on the table. This is a tricky episode to do because it's very hard to ever follow up on these studies.
Right.
But we are going to look at the broader question of what evidence is there that says video games may have been responsible for this case. And this particular case study is picked up by many researchers and also many people in the press. Mm. So it captures the attention of a lot of people, but then it sort of, you know, one of them goes to prison and that's it.
Right. And then no mention of the study ever again.
It's very, very quiet again. In fact, this sort of case study is something that happens quite regularly and the same thing is true. So the idea that racing games, driving games, car games, and I'm being broad now for the time being, because I could see you do a face there going, hang on, Mario Kart is different.
I was just thinking of Mario Kart.
Mario Kart's different to Need to Speed. Yeah. You're onto something. I could see it in your face. So we've got a newspaper headline, car crash blamed on video games. More recently in the Daily Mail, Britain 21 who organised street races for young elites who bet on events where drivers tried to copy video game with dangerous manoeuvres is arrested after 110 mile per hour crash in Spain. In the Telegraph, boy 11 leads police on dangerous car chase after Grand Theft Auto session. And last but not least, almost half of all motorists thinks video games and films are giving youngsters the wrong impression of driving.
Fuck off. Almost. What else do half of motorists think? I'm willing to bet all manner of dreadful things. Doesn't make any of them true.
I want to know what the worst thing we could do the research on of what half of motorists are willing to admit. I don't drive, Rich. Do you drive?
I do.
Do you drive? So we are the half of the there motorists. You go.
We are the sample. We are a representative sample of half of all motorists. Or I am.
Let's see what opinions you've got. Do you play racing games? So you played Need for Speed a long time ago.
I'm not a big gamer generally. I fucking love Mario Kart, though. So, you know, you mentioned that as a...
Okay.
Are you counting that as a racing game in this?
Are you chucking banana skins out of your window?
I don't think I've ever done that, but red shells when someone cuts me up big time.
That'd
be a no.
I do play a lot of driving games, so I really enjoy driving games. Although already we are stumbling across a problem that we are going to stumble across quite a lot in this episode, I think, which is that driving games aren't really a genre of things. There are lots of types of driving games that incorporate a very, very, very long history of video game history. So the first driving game is actually not a video game at all. The first mechanical arcade driving game was released in 1900, which I didn't realise it went...
What?
That back. It was called Yacht Race. We'll put a picture of Yacht Race on our Instagrams for people to have a look at.
Sorry, I'm struggling to even imagine what this looks like. What is this? What does it consist of, this game?
So you have two boats. Yeah. So two, like, little
like a model
boats.
Boat.
Yeah, a model boat, and then a mechanical wave, and then you spin a little mechanical mechanism, and the waves go, and, you know, the person who spins the fastest wins, from what I can gather.
Right. How big are we talking? Like a tabletop?
So it's like it's a stand-up, like mechanical, like arcade cabinet size.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
A bit like the things you see at fairgrounds, where like the horse is kind of like racing along.
Yes,
is it that sort of?
It's similar thing, but right. Imagine it in a glass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it is a two-player game.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So exactly that. That mechanism actually is sort of the mechanism that's used in the early video game. Kind of driving racing games.
Okay.
So the first sort of like broadly kind of agreed upon arcade racing game was published in 1969, was called Speedway, and then followed, as all of this sort of history of video games, lots of imitators in the arcades. Mm-hmm. But quite similar, kind of moving, like film image, the way that, you know, they do it in Hollywood. So back projected video and then little mechanical kind of toys, yeah. But with electronics. This continues into the 1970s, where we get the first sort of sit-down racers. By the late 1980s, there's polygon graphics. I'm really doing a bad, very, very quick history of other things. And that gets us to 1994, which is when Need for Speed, or The Need for Speed, which is the first of 23 Need for Speed games.
Wow.
Yeah, they pump them out. They really do pump them out. Which is partly starting to do some of the things that I think a lot of contemporary racers we would expect to see. So stuff like quote-unquote realism. Mm-hmm. Although, again, I think we're going to talk about this a couple of times. The idea of realism in video games is something that cracks me up, because the second you're past 5 years, you're like, is that really realistic? We'll see an example of that next. Stuff like tuning your car, and the Need for Speed gets a lot of mainstream attention because you have races with the police and you try and escape police.
So why are we going straight to Need for Speed rather than things like Outrun and stuff like that? They were like 80s, like late 80s?
Yeah, Outrun? So 80s is part of the polygon graphics.
Right, okay.
And the kind of arcade cabinets, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
There is a lot of racing games, so I'm doing most potted history to give you a sense of... Racing games have been around for as long as there's been mechanical and then electronic and then digital games. The reason why I'm doing this is to get us to the next clip, which is pretty much as long as there's been video games about racing, there has been anxieties about what is being encouraged in video games about racing.
Okay.
So I'm going to show you a news report about one of the earliest video games where driving over people is rewarded by points. Okay. Or not people, but driving over something that could potentially, arguably, resemble a person is rewarded. So this is Death Race, which was published in 1976, and this is the news report.
Even better than movies and television for getting into the act is your local pinball parlor. It provides an endless variety of methods for a little synthetic killing. It's all harmless fun, says the Californian who devised Death Race. In Los Angeles, Paul Jacobs.
Death Race really is fantasy, and nothing more than that. And we don't try to depict anything that really happens in real life. Well, first of all, just a new twist into the game. We took the cabinet, painted it black, and tried to project skeletons or gremlins running across the graveyard. And what happened now is when you drove your automobile, you ran into a skeleton. He emitted somewhat of a shriek, turned into a grave marker, and that's how we changed the game, and the sales went up quite a bit.
Right, it's not a Volkswagen, it's not a Christmas tree, right? It's a human being. Is it harmful? To the extent that it again sanctions practice, training, learning how to hurt, kill other people, it sets the stage for when people are instigated to aggression to use those skills that they have.
If you drive L.A. traffic, and I'm a deliverer myself, you know, you get tired of pedestrians. And these little things, you know, kind of remind me of pedestrians. Spooks. You're just supposed to run over the spooks and make the tombstones. They got little people running around. The object of the game is to run them over. I mean, that's a little sick. But it's fun.
These are not pedestrians. These are gremlins.
It's kind of like hitting people, but kind of not. Gremlins, because they're not real. I wouldn't want to run over anybody.
They're just little ghosts, I don't know. Just little people running around.
Whether or not those running, dodging robots are meant to represent people, it is agreed that they are turned into tombstones, and they do shriek when the hard-driving operator scores a bullseye. Got him.
Oh, man.
What are your immediate responses to this?
It's just all so laughable. The fact that they can't even agree on whether that's a person or a gremlin or a skeleton, but they do turn into tombstones. So this is clearly depraved. He doesn't sound very happy to be there at his job, the narrator, does he, as well? Would be my other takeaway from that. Very, very bored to be sent on this stupid assignment to a video game arcade to interview, sick, twisted teenagers.
I always enjoy watching this sort of stuff of just how quickly video game graphics become dated, and then you're seeing people very seriously be like, these are people. Are you sure?
It's moving a white blob into another white blob.
Yeah. It's so rudimentary.
Yeah, I guess the thing I'm always... I guess it's kind of what we started with. Like I said right at the top of the episode, the question that we're kind of dealing with, it sounds like bullshit. And it does. Whenever I see anything like this, it just sounds so ridiculous to me. And yet, it keeps happening, doesn't it? Like, these arguments, they never seem to die away. Like, they're always there. A new game comes out with slightly different graphics or a slightly different way of killing innocent bystanders or whatever. Yeah. And we're back to the same arguments again. There's something about that argument that the press, like, and just the people generally, I guess, can't seem to get away from.
Yes, that's something, that idea of repetition, this idea particularly that games where you can or do run over people. Mm. We see something like this. So there's a video game published in the UK called Carmageddon in the 90s.
Yes, I did play that.
Yeah, which is a classic. The Daily Mail really goes to town on Carmageddon. And, of course, Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
So when I pitched this episode to you, I was like, I can't be arsed doing video game violence right now. Like, it's too much. It's too big a case study. I want to save that for a later episode. We will do video game violence, but school shootings, all of that kind of stuff. I was like, I just want to put it to one side. Mm. And the second I started researching this, I was like, we're going to have to do video game violence. But through the medium of driving.
Okay.
Or partly that's part of the background noise of what is happening here is that the idea that you could potentially run somebody over, we see it in Death Race, we see it in Carmageddon, and we see it in Grand Theft Auto, and we see bunching of different types of games, quite different types of games, actually,
okay,
into a broad car racing game. So this is 1976. By the 90s and noughties, as you say, it keeps happening. Versions of this keep happening. I'm not sure it ever fully coalesces into a single, what you and I would call like a media or moral panic. I don't think it's as sustained as school shootings. I don't think there's ever a single story that can capture enough attention in the same way earlier case studies we've looked at. I don't think a single car crash can ever be a single. It never kind of dominates the news enough. Nevertheless, this question is always sort of in and around the surface of discussions around video games. It's sort of implied in conversations about Grand Theft Auto. It's implied in conversations about Need for Speed and other things like this. By the 2000s, it has become a research question, as these things tend to become. It's become something that certainly media psychologists are interested in. I don't think it garners as much attention as do video games cause school shootings or do video games cause violence, but it's very much attached to that type of question. They very much take the lead from, and this was frustrating in some of the readings that I was doing, it very much takes the lead of like, well, we know video games cause media violence,
right,
so what happens if something similar can be applied to cars or racing or driving or other things? So from the 2000s onwards until the present day, there's probably two or three dozen academic research papers that are primarily interested in the question of, do racing games cause reckless, aggressive, dangerous driving? And already those behaviours are slightly different. I think you can kind of really start to see, so often they open with their research problem, so they're sort of the thing that they're interested in. One 2013 study that opens with their research problematic, and I'm going to get you to read the quote.
Okay. Despite the potential negative consequences of risky driving, there is much risk-glorifying content in media, such as in street racing video games, movies, television shows, or advertisements. Wow, they are really implying that there is a very, you know, vibrant genre of street racing media out there.
Yeah. Well, I suppose Need for Speed would... I don't think that genre is a million miles away. I think that makes sense to me.
Video games, movies, TV shows, and advertisements, all about street racing specifically? That sounds really specific.
Yeah, outside of Fast and Furious, I start to slow down quite quickly on what I could name.
Yeah.
Advertisements.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Too Fast.
And all the rest of them.
We're not even up to Dwayne The Rock Johnson, exactly. So we could continue. Advertisements, yeah. Television shows, yeah. I mean,
so they're starting off. So this is like their opening gambit.
This is all within, the introduction, yeah.
So, and they're just stating there is lots of risk glorifying content.
Yes, you might have clocked on to what we're about to do.
Right. Okay.
Next, there's also another study from 2009, one of the more referenced in this genre of media effects, sort of racing, driving type stuff. Do you want to give that a read?
Okay. Photorealistic games often depict and even reward harmful, risky, and aggressive road traffic behaviours from a first-person perspective. players typically drive at high speed through urban environments, crashing into other drivers, performing reckless overtaking manoeuvres, intentionally killing pedestrians by driving over them, and destroying other cars by bumping into them. See the content of racing games such as Burnout, Need for Speed, or Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, and this article is at pains to stress that street racing is a growing problem in the US.
Mm. Is that true?
Yeah, I followed their links, and it's one LA police officer saying that there's possibly been a growth. I couldn't personally find any bigger studies that looked at that, because it's quite a small problem. The problem with any, when you get to like really nitty gritty behaviors like street racing, I'm not sure whether the police would have, you know, a separate crime category. I don't know how we'd measure that, and I certainly followed it up and I couldn't say anything about it.
So. Are we going to have to do an episode on did the Fast and the Furious franchise cause a rise in street racing?
So, believe it or not, one of the few studies that I think is interesting that possibly has a better methodology than some of the stuff that we're going to speak to actually does claim that.
Amazing!
So we might have a future episode, because I came across it whilst I was reading this, and I've read the paper, and it was reasonably interesting. It was coming at it from a slightly more macro thing. So potentially we can discuss that as we continue. So I'm going to talk you through some of the studies. So like I say, there's about two dozen, maybe approaching like three dozen. It's not the biggest genre of research. They are well referenced, or reasonably well referenced. They're picked up certainly in other places, which is, I think, interesting. But I just want to talk you through, how do you measure that? Because for me, that first question of, like, if you're making the claim that something does something, what are you doing to demonstrate that relationship? So there's a 2008 study that involved questionnaires of 2,193 adolescents on the impact of racing games and drive-em-up games.
Drive-em-up? Is that a...
So that would be Grand Theft Auto, so like beat-em-up, but...
I've heard beat-em-up and shoot-em-up, but like drive-em-up I've never heard.
Again, I think it's broadly recognisable. Okay. I don't think it's in everyday... I wouldn't call these games... Again, we're already starting to squash a... I think Need for Speed and Grand Theft Auto are very different games, even though...
Yeah.
The theme of escaping police officers is probably in both. They are also very, very different games. They're, you know, a different genre of game. The meanings attached to them are very different games. So they did this questionnaire with a couple of thousand adolescents on the impact of these games, on their intention to engage in risky driving. 91 and a bit percent of them didn't have a driver's license yet.
Oh, and this got published.
And this was published, and this is reasonably influential in the research. I was going to do a whole section on, I was just going to read you some methods, but do you want to immediately respond in a more grown-up way than just giggling at this study for 30 seconds?
Can I just giggle? Okay, I'll try. All right. Well, so I guess this study has something in common with a lot of other studies that we have and will continue to touch on in other episodes of this show, which is about the difference between intention to behave in a certain way and actually behaving in that way. So, you know, this is something that comes up quite a lot in a lot of consumer research, you know, like about purchase intention, for example.
Sure, yeah.
Are people going to go on to actually buy something? Like, oh, 67% said that they would buy it.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah, but...
Do they actually go out and buy it? There's a difference, right, between those two things. Someone saying they're going to do something and then actually do something is completely different. The idea that 91% didn't have their driver's license yet, I mean, that just... Again, I'm trying to be grown up about this and not get... But, like, that's just a terrible sample then. Like, why? Why talk to those people? At least talk to people who do have their license. Or at least... Like, because that's a... They've got a big sample. They've got 2,000 people.
Reasonably big, yeah, yeah.
And then why adolescents?
So I think the assumption was that... So they work backwards from young people are more likely to be involved in car crashes. So that is statistically accurate. And therefore, we want to find out, why do young people who are just starting to drive, more likely the most of the group of young people, the most likely to be involved in accidents. So we need to capture them before they started driving to have a look at what could potentially be influencing them on the way to before they've had a lesson, I suppose.
Because young people weren't having car crashes before video games came along, right?
You're ruining the episode, man. Like, come on. But yes.
Sorry, we got some historical stuff going on.
But I mean, yeah, it's to me, there's many multiple things here that I'd look at. I suppose it's easy to do questionnaires with teenagers because you send them to schools. That's part, like, you know, it's notoriously hard to get people to fill in questionnaires. So I think there's an element of that going on. But that question of intention, I'm not defending the research. I'm just trying to kind of their thinking on what they're doing.
I mean, I guess I just on a really practical level, like, you're right that it is difficult to get people to fill out questionnaires and research and participate in research. But like, what do most American universities do is they ask American college age students, like, what, just do that at least. Like,
that's coming up.
Oh, okay.
Well, let's move on. So another study, again, questionnaire, 503 respondents, including self-perceptions of whether they consider themselves a risky driver, attitudes regarding street racing, video game playing, self-reported risky driving, and then, yeah, statistical analysis to see if there's correlations between them. Immediate thoughts on that?
Well, self-perception is... I'm not saying that's not interesting. I would be interested to know the results of that, but I don't think it tells us anything about whether video games actually cause any behaviour change.
Yep. I think what's interesting in that one is immediately we're conflating two quite different things, which is risky driving that potentially all drivers, or I'd even go so far and say most drivers have done something that would be considered risky, whether that's, you know, overtaking somebody that maybe they shouldn't be doing, driving fast, and then street racing, which is a pretty narrow category of driver. Like, very few people have been involved in street racing.
Yeah. But also, couldn't you say that perception of risk is not necessarily a good measure of actual risk? Because surely the most, like, say, a Formula One driver or something, they're taking the biggest risks, but they're probably very confident, and rightly so, because they know what to do. But actually, they're much more likely to have a high-speed collision than anyone else. But
yes.
Do you see what I mean? Like, there's a difference there between how you perceive your own risk and what your actual risk of causing an accident is.
Yeah, I think asking people whenever you ask them to rate themselves on anything, like you've already indicated, I already have methodological questions.
It might have value, but you have to be really careful with that, I'd say, if you're doing that kind of research.
Potentially interesting, but also maybe not answering the question of who's more likely to actually be involved in car accidents. Mm. The next one kind of starts to get at what you were talking about. So this is 34 undergraduates. We finally have reached the psychologist's favourite sample, which is your own class. 34 students played 30 minutes of a racing game and then that were asked to return the following day. There's this study that gets used in certain types of driving psychology. So the following day they're shown video clips of a potentially dangerous situation in driving. So they're shown it once and then they're shown it again and they're asked to click a button when they would exit the manoeuvre. And then they subject the seconds to statistical analysis.
The same clip?
The same clip, yeah.
But they've seen it before?
Yeah.
So wouldn't they know when the risks are going to come up?
So I suppose on that, they're not trying to surprise them. They're just trying to kind of gauge when would you personally. So nothing, you're not responding to the clip necessarily. You're responding to your own perception of when you would exit the situation.
So they've already had time to digest that, Ben.
Yeah, they've already had time to digest that. And I think, so what confused me a little bit on this one was the idea that people who pull out of the clip quicker are safer drivers. I can't quite figure out. Maybe it makes more sense if you've seen the clips, but I think sometimes it would be safer to be like, well, I need to make sure, otherwise I'm putting my brakes on.
Yeah.
We're talking about, it's a second difference between the two groups. And it's, you know, two groups of 16 or whatever.
I mean, a whole second can be quite a lot in
Sure. No, like that's interesting. Yeah. So some of this stuff, like, you're absolutely right. A second is important. That's something to kind of look for. Quite a lot of them use simulators. So similar again, you have one group play one type of game, another group play a control game, and then they use a simulator to kind of measure dangerous driving, speed, other things like that. I think the simulator stuff is reasonably interesting because there's a massive debate in the body of scholarship that is concerned with road safety. So I suspect, in fact, what is your response to the use of simulators to kind of measure driving?
That's one of the best ones we've come across so far. I think you can at least equate how someone behaves on a simulator with how they behave when they're playing a video game. Those two things, I'm comfortable equating those two things. I still would say there's a difference between that and actual driving, though, because fundamentally, however good the simulator is, you know that it doesn't really matter if you crash.
Yes, so that's exactly that debate in the road safety literature is kind of interesting. I think in the video game stuff, it becomes quite interesting as well, is in the literatures on what video games are good for in terms of what do they train you to be able to do. The basic answer is they train you to play video games. So if the simulator looks like a video game, it becomes quite messy to look at the overlaps of, like, well, when does the video game and the simulator, given that the simulators look and play like video games, it's quite different to, you know, real life driving conditions. Mm. We obviously quite quickly run afoul on ethics. So part of the reason why simulators are used is I want to test whether drivers are more dangerous or not in under certain conditions becomes really, really messy. From what I read, simulators are quite useful. So what they're really good for is actually measuring psychology. So if you genuinely want to find out how much slower are drunk drivers or drivers under the influence of drugs compared to a driver who's not, simulators are really, really good for kind of, that's where it's good for kind of different groups. I think the video game stuff tries to kind of come into the slipstream of that a little bit, and it's not quite measuring the same thing. But there's a rationale there for using it. I think it's kind of interesting. There was a section in the 34 students playing the video games and then doing the video testing, which I just wanted to use because to me it's so indicative of what's potentially happening here. So the authors of this study from 2009 say, after the participants had done the study, they were thoroughly debriefed about the real aim of the research. Special care was taken to ensure that no participant left the lab with risk-promoting or other negative thoughts and feelings.
I mean, that's great. If they have the power to do that, then couldn't we just do that?
They bury the lead, right? If you figured out a way to deprogram kids from dangerous driving.
Yeah, then then everyone could play all the games that they wanted to play as long as they go through this deprogramming process that these guys have come up with. And Bob's your uncle.
Everybody's happy. Yeah, I love that so much. You know where you're like, I wish there was a second highlighter on my tablet for that bit of the study. We've looked at a couple of those studies. There is many more. But broadly, I think you get a flavour of the type of research that is being done to test this question of, is video games causing dangerous driving? Pretty much all of them come to some form of correlation. So they do find what they think is a relationship between the people who play video games are more likely to engage in types of driving that would be considered more dangerous than the groups that don't.
Okay.
Most of these studies find a form of correlation and then work from there into an assumption about causation. So this is a classic problem in any type of research, is trying to prove causation when you found correlation. What do you understand by those terms?
Yeah, it's what the word sounds like, correlation, co-relation. It's two things that seem to be related to each other. One thing seems to be, you know, going up as another thing is going up, for example. But it's like a key kind of principle in kind of any kind of statistical analysis that correlation and causation are not the same thing. Just because two things seem to be happening at the same time, for example, or both going up at the same time or both going down at the same time, that doesn't mean that one thing is causing the other. There's all sorts of websites where you can go and find, you know, relationships between the number of Nicolas Cage movies released each year and the number of floods in, you know, the southern United States or something like that.
Exactly.
And they kind of are correlated, but there's no possible way they could, one thing could be causing the other.
Yeah. So many of these studies settle on a singular idea for what might be causing the correlation that they think they're finding in this research. So I've pulled out one quote that I think is particularly useful here. Do you want to read it?
Yeah, which one's this from? Which study is this
so
from?
So this is from the questionnaire study, so the bigger questionnaire study about self-perception.
Okay. So it says, active participation, as opposed to passive consumption of viewing pictures or reading articles, is especially relevant as video games require self-involvement through the active control of the game character. This is a big one in video games, isn't it?
They love it. They love it so much.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, like, one of the problems historically with, like, TV and the idea of, like, you know, people sitting there being like a couch potato and it, like, you know, the idea of the goggle box and all this kind of stuff is, like, that it's too passive, right? That people just sit there and are, like, stupefied into like, this zombie-like state of compliance. Whereas now it's like, oh, they're not passive enough. They're actively involved in, you know, mowing down innocent blobs of light on a screen.
Yeah. We saw it in the earlier news report, yeah. That sense of like, well, you're in control. When they sort of drill down into this a little bit more, the idea of self-perception becomes quite important. So if you perceive of yourself as a dangerous driver, you are more likely to engage in dangerous driving. Therefore, if you regularly prime yourself into thinking you're a dangerous driver because you are playing dangerous driving video games, that you're more likely to then behave like that when you're on the road.
It's interesting that the clip you showed me before, did you say that was from 1976?
Yeah, 76, yeah.
So that is very close to the release. Because one of the things in that clip is about like the first-person perspective and like you're the one in the car mowing down these people or whatever. And this is a very similar point in time to Halloween coming out, the film, which opens with a scene where Michael Myers, the first person perspective, the murder, and there was all sorts of stuff around there. And like not just that film, but like slasher movies in general. The big claim was that these films were somehow encouraging people to take on the perspective of a deranged homicidal maniac or something, and like make you sympathize with that and could almost like change your psychology, which in turn would change your behavior and would turn you into a serial killer or a reckless driver or whatever. So it's quite closely linked. Just interesting that those two things happen quite close together.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm quite interested in, once you start to read across the literature, that the willingness to chuck other researchers under the bus. Like, well, the film stuff was clearly not true because it's very passive consumption. But video games, like, we found it this time. I'm always quite intrigued by this. As you will not be surprised by, and I think we read one of the headlines of what was reported, these are quite popular in the press. Again, it's not front page news, but these sorts of studies are picked up on regularly, in the English language press. This is a quality press release from a university press office, and these are picked up by journalists who want to do them. I think you covered most of the things that I'm a little bit frustrated by with this research. Like, it's the vast majority, all of it is questionnaire or really experimental, survey-based, lab-based designs. It's worth saying this. The data's so messy.
Yeah.
Like, you really dig into the data. Like, I'm not trained in data analysis, but it's really noisy. And I think if you've only got 36 college-age students and you're breaking them into two groups, like, it's going to be inevitably, even if you are looking at something even like, you know, smoking and coughs, like, it's already noisy data by how small the sample is, how limited your sample size is, how limited by what you're kind of including. So I think it's worth kind of looking at. I mean, if anyone takes anything from this podcast, any study that only has undergraduates, I don't think you should chuck it out, but I do think that kind of, whether it's medical research, whatever it is, like, undergraduates are not the best group to look at particular things. I suppose there's an argument here because we're trying to study sort of young people in driving. That would be the discussion that we'd have. They don't put any causation down. They fail to prove on those terms. What I quite like about this research is a lot of them are quite honest about that.
That's good.
Yeah. Fair so play. A lot of them aren't, but the better ones, I'm like, well, this is interesting. I quite like science-y research that's quite open about what it didn't find and the limits of its own research. And many of them are like this. They're like, we may have found something interesting we may have not done. There's things to happen here. We've spoken about this quite a lot, but I do think it's worth stressing the slippiness of racing games. And I think you were like, yeah, is that a genre? Like how you're defining what games you're looking at? Many of them don't explain the specifics of the game that you looked at. So you're like, well, this is already quite tricky. Many of them group cluster together different types of games, which I think is tricky.
There's also the idea that, like, how can they... Are they even sure that the way that they get these people to play the games for the purposes of the experiments, is that the way they would play them in their own house? Because because a lot of these games, there are different ways of playing it. I don't just mean, like, you know, single player versus multiplayer, but, like, particularly something like Grand Theft Auto. Like, there are a million different missions and ways you can approach different things. You can just walk around beating people up if you want. You can do the missions. You can, as I sometimes do, just drive around and pay attention to all the rules.
I was about to say that, and I thought you were going to judge me. I was the nerdiest 14-year-old kid. I'd go to my mate's house, and I'd be like, I'm just going to drive properly.
Well, it feels kind of funny to do it, doesn't it? Because I think what I would say, Ben, is in the context of a game that is so spectacularly violent, the really punk rock thing really is to adhere to all traffic regulations.
But that point of like so little engagement with these as texts, and I always feel like sorry for the people in these studies that are like, play this video game for 30 minutes. You're like, well, I don't play video games. Like, play the game. And you're how do you make it go? Like, there's so little engagement with like the different types of genres that are within this. The obvious, they are referencing back to already existing, highly, you know, popular mediated texts.
Yeah.
Like, the Need for Speed is not really engaging with street racing. It's engaging with other mediated objects about street racing. There's very little sense of the pleasures or the non-pleasures that are in this. And even in a game like Grand Theft Auto, like, it's a satire. I know it's obvious to point that out, but it's kind of making fun out of American urban life. It's engaging with other genres and other things like this. And it's a really obvious point, but you are punished. Like, you don't want the police to chase you in GTA. Eventually, they will catch you. So even within there's very little engagement with the text. If they tell you what games they've had these people play, they're quite different and they're being clustered into other things. I think the main thing that I took from this was, if the argument is playing a game for 30 minutes is powerful enough to have an influence that 24 hours later people are dangerous drivers, we should be able to see that socially, right? It seemed like such an obvious thing for me to check whether, since these games have been published, has there been any sort of increase in car crashes? And it's not a bit of data that I'd ever really thought about or looked at before. So I was reasonably pleasantly surprised, I suppose. Or I wasn't shocked by this, because the second I stopped to think about it, I was like, okay, that makes sense. But broadly, I was like, okay, oh, that's kind of good to know. That on the whole, since the 1960s, there has been a massive decline in injuries, car crashes, deaths. However you want to measure it, driving is much, much safer now than it was 50 years ago. That there is a peak from the early decades of driving. The first sort of 30 or 40 years of driving are infinitely more dangerous than they have been since the 2000s and 2010s. I checked across pretty much the global north. All of this is true everywhere.
But Ben, what's to say that these figures wouldn't be even lower if it wasn't for those pesky video games?
So I suppose this is the argument, right? That you go, okay, but that doesn't necessarily... There are still accidents, and we don't know what are causing the accidents. I do think if a video game is powerful enough after 30 minutes of play to trigger something 24 hours later, you should see blips. Grand Theft Auto is the best-selling media franchise ever in any genre and any medium. Like, there is nothing to suggest that these sorts of blips are happening. What I did find in this, so I was sort of intrigued because, again, this is possibly me just being a bit dim, but I was like, oh, I would have expected the first couple of decades to be quite safe because there's not many drivers at all, and like there's not much to go on. Mm. So I went back to investigate this. We don't need to spend ages on this, but I just sort of was fascinated of like when you do a long history of dangerous driving, the idea of the reckless dangerous driver predates the motor car. So I've lifted a quote from an amazing book, which we'll come on to again in a second, by Karen Lumsden, which is about the history of the boy racers and boy racer culture. Oh. This is a quote from a local newspaper at the time that was complaining about pre-automobile drivers.
Okay. Drunk drivers, men driving without due care and attention, sometimes without reins... sometimes with overloaded carts, causing congestion and contributing to accidents in Manchester's Piccadilly in 1896.
Yes. So the idea of young men, different types of groups of drivers who are bad drivers, who aren't driving correctly, is repeated in the era of the horse and cart.
Amazing.
Yes. So I thought that was just an interesting little tidbit, but yeah. I think it's worth reflecting on when we kind of go, ah, today's youth, they don't know how to drive. And similar things were kind of argued in 1896. What I also found interesting, the idea of drivers and passengers and the anxieties and stresses of living in an era that is becoming mobilised, that where cars are becoming mainstreamed. So this was in Detroit in the 1920s and 30s. They used to do a thing called Safety Day or Safety Fairs. And part of the Safety Fairs, it was really about, people who were on the streets, mothers of children who were quite used to having the streets to play in. All of a sudden you've got cars that are turning up. So part of the reason why there's quite a big, moment in the 1920s and 20s and 30s where driving is really dangerous is because there's very, very few laws. There's very few speed laws. There's very few technical requirements for cars to have. Hmm. There's not lessons that you need to do. So you imagine rich people are getting cars and driving around quickly, and there are lots and lots and lots of crashes and accidents and deaths. So this kind of safety event or safety fair was a way of sort of trying to push back and obviously failing if you know the kind of broad history of America and the car. But I just found it quite touching, and as someone who is a non-driver and who gets quite frustrated with how much space cars have in city landscapes, this was a moment, I suppose, where it could have gone either way, and it obviously went in favour of the car. But they used to kind of have parades with floats that would kind of carry depictions of cars driving into children, like cars represented as demons, death-dealing demons, and posters that showed mothers holding limp children who were accident victims, God. To quote Peter Norton. Yeah. Amazing essay about these safety events and like the early years of kind of conflict between drivers and people on the pavements. But yeah, really, really lovely historical essay. But it just captured like the idea of dangerous driving has been around since cars have existed. And in many ways, it's a lot safer now than it was in the 1930s. So there's other ways of trying to imagine dangerous driving that long predate video games.
So were those safety days, were they like pretty much like the first public safety announcement, kind of like, you know, the precursors to those kind of campaigns like road safety and things like that? Is that the first time this happens?
I think, the earliest combinations of, because they can go in different ways. And I think what Peter Norton's trying to do in that essay is trying to capture that for the drivers, the idea of jaywalkers, that it was the people on the streets that shouldn't be there that was the problem. So they were kind of releasing their own very early, posters, advertising campaigns to try and, you know, get people to kind of look before you cross and those other things. But from the other side, if you're the mother of a child that's died in a car crash, you're trying to push back against the cars being in your space. So there's a real conflict, social conflict between drivers and non-drivers about what constitutes safety. Like, the idea of safety is quite inbuilt for us, I think.
Yeah.
But like, then it was quite different, and they were still trying to establish like who was responsible, where responsibility lay. I think there's something really interesting in this debate that like no one kind of captures this kind of fully, of like, we rarely think about car crashes as violence. That's sort of, it's in there, but it's also not. Like, so we kind of see it as like a separate category of violence that's enacted, partly because the car is doing the violence. There's sort of a distance there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so there's something going on there. You've already, again, looked ahead of where I sort of wanted to head with this. So from the 60s, so the height of death rates in car crashes, whether that's people in the car or outside of the car or whatever it is, but the height of death, the death rate is in 1966. So there's a question there for me of like, well, why does driving get safer from 1966 onwards? Which again, I don't think video games have anything to do with this, but there is that interesting kind of, if we go back to that early death race report, that like the potential for video games to be making more dangerous drivers, we just don't see it in the data because it gets safer, like much, much safer from the 70s onwards. If I ask you to speculate on why driving becomes safer in the 60s, what would you say?
Well, it's going to be the cars, isn't it? I would guess. Like the technology in the cars in terms of, you know, roll cages and bumpers and stuff like that, all the crash test dummy sort of, you know, safety experiments and things like that.
Yeah, so I think
seatbelts being, you know.
So there's loads of answers as why more people survive crashes, why fewer crashes happen in the first place.
Yeah.
All of these different things. Improved technologies in the car, handling.
When does the highway code come in? Like, you know, things like that.
All of these. So improvements in laws.
Yeah.
It's around that time. Absolutely.
Speeding fines, I'm guessing. I don't know when that came in.
Absolutely.
But, you know,
The enforcement of speeding fines, more police is often kind of given as part of this. All of the things, like multifaceted, to do with the cars themselves, to do with public awareness. So we get the first public awareness kind of public campaigns, video campaigns in the UK in the 1950s. I think it's a little bit earlier in the US, but it's around this time. Obviously, the expansion of mass media, you can get and reach more people. So again, that question of like, does the media create safer drivers? I don't think that's the right way to look at it, but I think advertising campaigns are part of this.
Mm.
Certainly in the UK, I know attitudes are a little bit more different in the US still, but in the UK we get drink driving becomes a lot less socially acceptable from the 60s and 70s onwards. This is all in the literature. I'm not sure it's necessarily a huge debate necessarily in the literature as the primacy of one of these things over other things. There's a lot going on, basically. Repeated governments have goals to reduce car crashes and then in-car crashes, deaths, safety standards, better driving schools, you know, more stringent driving exams. All of these different things are taking place. There's something which I love because mathematicians, God bless them, come up with amazing little ways of understanding data. So I think this is when statistical analysis is really, really interesting. There's something in this body of literature called Smead's Law, which was something devised by a fella called Reuben Smead, which broadly goes, the involvement of each vehicle in a fatal crash decreases as the number of cars in a country increases, which seems broadly counterintuitive, but also when you sort of think it through, basically the argument is the more cars there are, the slower you go, and the slower you go, the less likely you are involved to be in a crash. So there's like, people have tried to work out, you know, some people's whole research career is trying to work out why Smead's Law holds up in pretty much every developing nation. You hit a certain point where kind of there's more cars on the road and there's less likely to be certain types of crashes.
Yeah.
So there's more crashes but less less deaths within
that makes sense.
Kind of crash. Yeah. To capture this, and also to demonstrate why correlation might not always be causation, I've pulled out something I didn't know existed until I did this research, and I think is excellent. So this is, it's not the earliest TV safety campaign, but it's one of the earliest UK safety campaigns. So the earliest, there's a few videos in the kind of 1950s. This is from 1967, and I'm not going to tell you anything about it. I just want you to watch it and then respond to it immediately.
Hello, citizens. I'm taking a holiday from crime fighting in Gotham City. No rest from danger, though, because all around us is that deadly daily danger, traffic. I admire the way all you British children triumph over this danger by learning and using the road safety code, like curb drill. Before crossing the road, you stop at the curb, look right, look left, look right again, and then only if the road is clear, walk quickly across. Now, children, how does it go? At the curb, stop. Look right, look left, look right again. If all's clear, walk quickly across. Remember, be smart, be safe. Always do your curb drill.
That's amazing. He also just held the look to camera for about 10 seconds at the end there. That's why. Wow. I mean, I wish I'd had that when I was little. We had something called the Tufty Club, which was a massive anthropomorphized squirrel.
Oh, right. Okay.
Who taught us the green cross code. You must stop, look, and listen whenever you cross the road. But yeah, Batman. It just makes me miss the Adam West versions. You know, as much as there's a lot to like about the Chris Nolan very serious Dark Knight kind of trilogy, I think it's the Adam West one's so much more fun. What year did you say that was from?
So this is from 1967.
Right. So that was the year after. So you said that the peak was 1966, and then 67 comes out. So maybe we have to thank Batman.
You've stolen my point and my line there. I was going to propose something called the Batman effect, which is that since the appearance of Batman on British TV in 1966, there has been a dramatic reduction in car accidents, including the video that we've just seen.
Holy correlation, Batman!
I want to come on to the final bit of where we're at in terms of the video game causing driving. And I think Batman gets us there a little bit, because obviously it's silly to suggest that Batman alone is causing a decline in accidents. But it isn't silly to suggest that the media is part of a much bigger context in which it has a part to play in being one of the ways that social attitudes can change, which is a lot of the number of caveats I've put in that is the number of caveats that I want to see in there. But there is a separate body of literature, I suppose, that comes at this from a very different viewpoint. One of my eternal frustrations whenever I do these sorts of episodes is that these two bodies of literature are not talking to one another. The body of literature that is solely concerned with like road safety and other things aren't particularly interested in the video game literature either. So the video game dangerous driving effects research is almost on its own over here and is speaking to other people interested in video games and effects. You've got the car safety stuff, which is broadly trying to work out how do we make the road safer, how do we make cars safer, and so on.
Are they at least interested in media? Like, are they interested in, say, like videos like that Batman video?
I think so, yeah. They're very much, that is part of the mix in terms of like education, in terms of social attitudes. So absolutely, that is psychologies of driving. And this is where, because I think on this podcast, we can be a little bit harsh towards psychologists. Fairly, I would suggest. But, you know, we can be a little bit harsh. But I also think there is a role to play. Like, the psychology of driving is fascinating.
Of course.
Like, why do people get angry or not angry? What causes somebody in a split second to make a decision or not make a decision? All of those things, I think, you know, are particularly fascinating. And there is loads of good psychological research that looks like it's trying to get at this. in terms of the dangerous driving stuff, there is a body of literature that is concerned with the boy racers themselves, or representations of dangerous driving, or representations of street racing, or all of these other things. The starting point whenever you do this is that if we are talking about driving and cars, is that they're such ideologically loaded. You know, yeah. They have so much meaning attached to them through all of the things that we have been talking about. I think video games are part of this. So let's do in British culture and American culture. So what does the car mean, do you think, in sort of American culture? What types of ideas do we attach to it?
I mean, I think of it in terms of, like, you know, the idea of freedom and kind of, you know, classically Manifest Destiny and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think, obviously, it's Manifest Destiny is way before the invention of cars. But what I mean is the idea of, you know, the open road, Route 66, going where you want, individualism, things like that. The rise of consumer society in the early 20s, I think. And I think particularly having briefly lived in the States as well, I think it's such a state, sort of a symbol of independence. As you grow up, you get your license like 15, 16 over there. And that immediately makes you an adult in a sense, because you are then free to kind of travel around and everything's so spread out. They don't have the public transport kind of facilities and infrastructures that we have here in the UK, for example, or in other parts of Europe. So the car is the primary way that they get around.
Yeah, that's absolutely in the kind of analysis of the car, all of those things, the idea of free spirits, open road. And again, I don't think you need a PhD in media studies to necessarily kind of capture that. I think it is reproduced in literature, in films, in, you know, TV, in magazines, all of these things. They are nodes in something that broadly constructs an ideology of that. I think it's slightly different in the UK. So what would you say kind of driving culture has in the UK? What sort of kind of programs or things would you kind of attach to it?
Well, I mean, I think of things like Top Gear, and I guess is a more recent example. But, like, I guess the other thing I could have mentioned for both US and UK is masculinity is kind of the other obvious elephant in the room there. Yeah. Which comes to mind.
Yes. So we'll talk about masculinity in a second. Okay. It's absolutely. So whenever you get into the studies of this, I mean, it's again there in particularly in the UK context where we talk about boy racers, like, it's already gendered.
Yeah.
There's no escape from it.
I guess in this country, maybe because in the UK we have a slightly different kind of, well, actually a fairly different class structure as well. And the car has often been a sort of symbol. It's a symbol of status everywhere, but I think perhaps more of a symbol of social class in parts of the UK, maybe. I don't know.
I think
that's important on both sides of the Atlantic, actually.
I think class plays out differently, and the race is also going to be part of this. So there's some really nice studies of, like, Latino racers in LA, and young Latino men in particular.
And in this country and this part of the country, particularly in the UK, in West Yorkshire, you know, we're close to places like Bradford, for example. Bradford has a very large South Asian population, and, you know, really big car cultures among young men, hanging out in car parks, showing off their cars to each other and all that kind of stuff, which I think is fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, many sociologists have also found that kind of interesting, fascinating, and actually a source of, if you want to understand how and why people do or don't get involved in street racing, actually going to the spaces where street racing is happening, whether that is in LA or whether that is happening in kind of car parks or parks in and around, you know, the north of England or wherever it is. I was, again, surprised to read this has a much longer history going all the way back to kind of early car cultures. So, again, the idea of young men who race is pretty standard by the 1920s. Certainly in sociologies of the car, the idea of the quote-unquote deviant driver is quite a rich body of literature since the 1970s at the very least. So Howard Parker publishes The Joys of Joyriding in 1974, which is a qualitative ethnography of scouse lads who steal cars and then dump them.
Right.
So it's slightly different, but, you know, it's similar sort of kind of representation going on.
Rebel Without a Cause is about 1955?
Yes.
American kind of context.
So again, the fetishization of car crashes or the fetishization of speeding or going too fast is certainly predating all of the video games that we're looking at. There's an amazing book called Car Crash Culture, which is edited by Makita Brotman from the 2000s, which cultural representations of car crashes from Diana through to like everything in between. And again, just really interesting of like, as part of the fascination of cars, you know, the ideology of cars, the danger is part of the attraction.
Yeah.
So that's sort of underpinning it.
Do you know what? I've literally just remembered when I was probably about 13, 14, I went to a Disney World, it would have been in Florida, and bought a license plate with James Dean's face on it, and it said "Live Fast" on it. I was a kid. Like,
how does the quote end?
Exactly.
What now?
Like, what's it? What's that going to do for me? Like, it's a terrible lesson to be, you know, putting out. Why was that for sale in Disneyland as well?
And look at you now. Similar studies take place. Beatrix Campbell on Joyriders in Oxford in 1993. Howell on Boy Racer Culture in 2005, Karen's own work, which we've mentioned in this podcast already, on Boy Racers in 2013. There's an author called Amy Best who does stuff in LA, a book called Fast Cars, Cool Rides. So there is a reasonably rich set of studies running parallel to the video game effects research, almost sort of in the same sort of years, and they are just not talking to one another. So most of these researchers, all of these researchers, start with the people, and they go and interview the people, and they get, as often happens when you do actual interviews with people, you get much, much messier findings. So one of the things that Karen finds out that I was sort of surprised that the boy racer, quote unquote, as a kind of subculture, you said, like, young lads meeting in car parks to show off their cars. Obviously, status, subcultural capital. So the idea that, you know, people are proud to kind of know what they know about the cars that they have. They want to demonstrate that they've got the best equipment or that they've spent the most or that their car is the cleanest. All of these other things. Some of them do drive fast. Some of them are interested in kind of racing. I don't think she's denying that that's the case. But what she found is a lot of them don't want to do that. A lot of them actually pride themselves on the fact that they're safe drivers. They're good drivers, right? So I'm a good driver. I follow all of the rules. I go fast when I'm allowed to go fast. I don't. And actually, similarly, whenever you do subcultural work of like, you know, punks look after their jackets. Like, it's actually quite a lot of work to look like that. Like, if you've spent that much money on your car, the last thing you want to do is to drive it into a wall. So she's got this beautiful anecdote of all of the drivers going home to watch Top Gear, which you mentioned, because they're very interested in Top Gear. So they do play racing games because that's part of their culture. They are watching Top Gear. They are interested in the films. But they drive home from the meet very safely. And I just kind of have this idea of these cars kind of trying to get home to watch Top Gear, but following all of the rules of the road.
I mean, I guess part of that is probably, you know, they might well have invested quite a lot of money on their cars, but that might be all of the money that they, all the disposable income they have. So
absolutely,
it's like, well,
yeah,
if they did get a crash or even a little dent or something, it's probably quite a lot of, that's a big imposition to kind of get it fixed. Whereas, you know, as you say, they wanted to keep it looking good.
Yeah. And I'm not, again, I'm not saying that none of these people are doing, you know, all of them are kind of people that fall under the laws. Clearly there are studies in here, but all of the kind of sociological analysis we'd expect to find in this sort of research of like the boys who are stealing cars are doing it as a form of rebellion because, you know, they're on working class estates at a time when there are a few jobs and, you know, one of the few things they can do to gain status is to commit. Like all of the kind of things that we would expect is sort of true. And when we get to the boy races in the 2000s and 2010s, it's slightly different. We're already kind of into subcultural stuff and into other things. There is a secondary body of research which is really just looking at driving as a social and cultural practice. That really, if you want to understand driving, you just need to understand how driving operates on the road, which is to say crashes happen, but when crashes happen, they're probably quite social. Somebody next to you did something that annoyed you and you stopped focusing on the car on the other side of you. The kids in the back were playing a game or kicking your seat. all of these different things, and that realistically, these are the sorts of effects that do cause crashes, and that there is, you know, a culture that exists on the road as well of, like, letting people out or not letting people out. We can use, you know, the social and cultural analysis that we're used to in other types of work. So Sarah Redshaw, I think her book, Driving as a Social and Cultural Practice, really captures all of these different debates. She's got a tiny section on the video game stuff, but I think how little attention it gets is indicative of how little interest the field has got in that. Like, if you want to understand how car crashes happen, video games are pretty low down the list, actually, if you come at it from that angle.
It just seems like a really random thing to fixate on when there's so many other factors which would seem to be more important.
Yeah, I'm coming back to it, but that point that if you're playing it for 30 minutes and you can see an effect that you think is going to cause crashes, it's, if it exists, and if I'm honest, I don't think it exists, but if it exists, it's drowned out by the context in which an accident may or may not happen.
Yeah.
There might be lots and lots of reasons that are taking place here. So to come back to the question that we started with, do racing games cause reckless and dangerous driving? What have we learned? I think there's something really interesting in this case study, because I do think that a lot of the boy racers that have been studied, if you do the qualitative research, these people are interested in car cultures and racing cultures really, really broadly. So they are probably more likely to be consuming films and playing video games where that is part of it. So when we find the Need for Speed video game in the car, I don't think that's completely irrelevant. I'm not sure it's, you know, there's nothing worthy of commentary there. But I also don't think you can draw a direct line between the video game on the seat and the car accident that causes it. I don't think you can draw a straight line between people who play video games for 30 minutes and people who then go and act as if they are more dangerous drivers. I think culture is a lot knottier than this.
Yeah.
Representations predate video games. The celebration of the car as an ideology predates, you know, literature about the car, or certainly trying to get a direct timeline where you place everything kind of one after the other, and at the end of it, there's people playing video games and they're now dangerous drivers. That clearly isn't happening here. Culture is possibly reflecting or refracting, or, you know, is part of a network of many, many, many different things that are taking place.
There's a bunch of things here. I mean, first of all, I'm less inclined to, you know, go along with the argument, as I think you were sort of suggesting there, in terms of, like, all right, we may, if you did the research, you may find that some of the people involved in boy racing were also playing some of those video games. But so are loads of other people who are playing
millions,
those video games.
Millions of people.
Far more people are playing those games and are not involved in anything.
It's not an important data point.
They might be into car cultures, they might be part of that, but that not necessarily like boy racers or whatever. The other thing is, I guess, just to go back again to that example that you opened with, which was the idea that the whole reason for blaming Need for Speed was it was just there. Yeah. It was just there on the seat next to it. And that, to me, that in a nutshell kind of tells us quite a lot about not just this specific problem that we're looking at this week, but a lot of the problems we look at on this podcast, which is the very way that people talk about social problems and how simplistic they see it. It's like this thing, it's like a game of Cluedo or something. It's like, well, there's a dagger on the floor, so that must be the murder weapon, and it must be this person because they were wronged by that person, and they must have come through the secret passage because we can see that the door was left open or whatever. Those clues may have some truth to them or whatever, but the point is that real social problems are not very easily explained by simple narratives like that, A plus B equals C.
Yeah.
And I think what I really want us to do with this podcast, but also the listeners out there, to kind of, when they see people making those arguments, to just, for a little red flag to go up, little alarm bell to ring, and to just go, it just seems a bit too neat. Because if it seems too neat, it probably is too neat. And, you know, we might as well, I'm willing to bet that, you know, an issue like masculinity, for example, is probably more of a factor in any of those car crashes than a video game.
Yeah.
But also trying to prove that would be, I mean, how do you how do you disentangle masculinity from a car crash, like the facts of a car crash, right? So it's opening up a can of worms, but that's kind of what I want to do with this stuff. I think we need to open more cans of worms, basically, Ben. I think starting with the people who are at the heart of these things is often a good way to go, trying to understand their lives and the other things that they've got going on, rather than just whatever happened to be sat next to them on the seat when they crashed.
Thank you so much for listening. I've been Ben.
I've been Rich.
The Robin to my Batman.
Oh.
If you like what we do, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. Please leave a review or recommend us to a friend or an enemy, or recommend us to anyone. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at IllEffectsPod. So if you want to see the long stare that Batman gives into the camera, or if you want to see the data about car crashes, that'll all be put up on there. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Drive safe.
You've been listening to Ill Effects. This episode was researched by Ben Litherland. It was produced by Rachel Wood. It was produced and edited by Caroline Pringle. Edited and mixed by Colin Frank. The music for our episodes was created by Brutalist, Colin Frank and Maria Sappho, and recorded and mixed by Joe Prisman.